I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane won't testify or call any defense witnesses at her perjury and obstruction trial. Closing arguments are scheduled for Monday. WHYY's Tom McDonald was in the courtroom this morning when Kane's defense rested its case and joins us now on Newsworks Tonight. Tom, what exactly happened this morning?
Kathleen Kane walked up to the court, sat in the jury box, and then said that she felt there was no need for her to testify, Brad. She reiterated it twice, and that was the width and breadth of the defense case. They said they didn't need to put any witnesses on because they believe that there is no need to put witnesses on because Kane is not guilty, and they believe once the case goes to the jury will rule that way. Now, the judge in the case was asked to make a ruling of innocent. She refused, so there will be closing arguments on Monday from both sides in the case, then a jury charge, and then the jury will have the final say in the matter.
This comes after a whole week of testimony from prosecution witnesses. Can you remind us what it was that they were trying to prove that she had done, and how did they went about trying to prove that?
Kane's accused of leaking grand jury evidence to the press and then lying about it under oath. That felony perjury charge can bring up to 7 years in prison. Two of her once trusted advisors this week told the jury she'd invented a story for the grand jury and framed someone else for the leak. One of them said he conspired with her on the plan. And this is very serious charges. And Kane decided that she wouldn't talk on the stand, some say because the cross-examination would have been brutal.
Now, speaking of cross-examination, the defense didn't put on their own case by calling witnesses or by putting Kane on the stand. But had they cross-examined some of these witnesses from the prosecution earlier in the week?
They cross-examined every prosecution witness during the week, and they went over the case step by step, including in some places saying that the case just wasn't made by the prosecution. The prosecution put on a very tight case, telling the story step by step of how Kane put this all together and allegedly was deceiving both the people involved and deceiving people involved with the media, making sure that she was removed from it so she wasn't directly able to be linked to it, except for the fact that there were text and phone conversations involved linking Kane to the situation.
Is there any way for us to know what the jurors or the prosecutors or anybody else is thinking right now?
Brad, everyone is still under a gag order in this case. They're not talking to the media. The witnesses are instructed not to talk to anybody until the case is over. And the jury is being told every time there's a beginning or a stop to the case that they're not to talk to anybody, listen to anything, read anything, go online. This gag order is a very tight one during this case.
So the closing arguments are scheduled for Monday at this point. The jurors haven't determined whether she's innocent or if she's guilty. But the allegations have already had a big impact on Kane. What's this meant for her career?
Well, her law license has been on hold ever since these allegations came out. She really can't directly run her office because she's not a lawyer. And her future as a lawyer and a politician's in jeopardy. She also didn't run for re-election, so for now, she's going to be private citizen Kathleen Kane come the first of the year.
So what are we expecting to happen on Monday?
Well, you know, closing arguments in a case like this are very complicated. They'll take hours for both sides. Then the jury will be given a charge, which is the law instructions by the judge, telling them how they can guide their deliberations. Then for the first time, the jurors will be allowed to talk amongst themselves and decide off of a charge sheet whether or not Kane is guilty or innocent. And, of course, there is that third possibility that the jury doesn't come to a final decision. That's called a hung jury.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Brad.
That's WHYY's Tom McDonald. Former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky was back in court today for a hearing under the Post-Conviction Relief Act. Sandusky claims his original representation was insufficient. If a judge agrees, the case could be reconsidered. Sandusky took the stand for the first time in this four-year saga, and his lawyer, Al Lindsay, says it gave the former assistant coach a chance to tell the story in his own words.
We're very happy to get him on the stand today to say that he was innocent of these charges, because he's never been able to say that. The way that this thing has been set up, it just didn't happen.
Sandusky claims his original counsel, Joseph Amendola, didn't let him testify, made him speak on national TV without proper preparation, and waived a preliminary hearing. Based on these and other charges, Sandusky's seeking a reconsideration of his case. The debate over late Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo's legacy got heated today after a Black Lives Matter activist placed a white Ku Klux Klan-style hood on the head of Rizzo's statue in Center City. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports the demonstration didn't last very long, but it was the latest scene in a growing tensions over the Rizzo statue near City Hall.
After placing a hood on the Rizzo statue, Asa Khalif with Black Lives Matter and one other protester said he's a symbol of discrimination.
Black and brown people are being shot down by police, and then to come out with all this pain, generational pain, we got to deal with this. No, we say tear it down now.
No attempts were made to damage the 9-foot bronze statue on the steps of the Municipal Services Building, but the white hood stayed on for about 20 minutes.
20 minutes is 20 minutes too long. Someone should have been there as soon as possible and taken that off. That was disgusting. My mom and I watched that in horror.
Joe Mastronato is Rizzo's grandson. He says everyone who thinks the former mayor and police commissioner was a racist didn't really know him.
His two bodyguards were black men, real tough black men, and they were around him all the time. Like, I saw that with my own two eyes, and I spent an enormous amount of time with him.
An online petition to take down the Rizzo statue has attracted more than 900 supporters, but a counter petition to keep the statue where it is has gained just as many backers. Trying to square Rizzo's complicated past isn't easy, says Tawando Bullard as she passes the demonstration. Is this really the best way to handle it, she asks. She looks at the white hood on the statue and shakes her head.
I feel like Frank Rizzo was the best mayor for Philadelphia. I like the way he ran the city with an iron fist. He said what he meant and he meant what he said.
Mayor Jim Kenney says he'll have a discussion about the placement of the 1998 statue, but that, quote, a dialogue won't be started and finished over a few days and a few hundred signatures. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Now it's time for What Are We Thinking? Each week, Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller discusses American sentiment on various topics with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. This week, as presidential campaigns ramp up for the November election, the two take a look at the roster of Oval Office hopefuls.
Hey, Frank, let's focus on the presidential candidates. You pick the order. Libertarian Gary Johnson or Green Party Jill Stein to start?
Well, both of those individuals are certainly out there campaigning. Our data show they are not well known at all. 63% of Americans say they have never heard of Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, or at least don't know enough about him to even have an opinion. And a little higher percent, 68%, say they don't know anything about the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein. So clearly they're unknowns to many Americans, and those who do have an opinion of them kind of break even right down the middle.
Having said that, what support is specifically Johnson enjoying at this juncture?
Well, that's kind of interesting to look at and important as well, Dave. In trial heat polls that various firms have done, Johnson's averaging maybe around 8 or 9%. Stein much lower than that. But he's getting, despite a lot of people not knowing who he is, a not insignificant percent of people saying that they would vote for him. Generally, for these third-party candidates, the actual percentage of the vote they receive on Election Day shrinks from what is being shown in pre-election polls.
Is it your hunch that, say, Ross Perot or George Wallace once upon a time, that much of their support was also a protest vote, a none of the above, rather than on their merits?
Yes, almost by definition. When you're a third-party candidate, you are running outside of the Democratic and the Republican Party, and so you are gathering the sentiments of individuals who are obviously not satisfied with either of those other two parties. Perot, you'll remember, got 19% of the popular vote back in 1992, and I think we've talked about it before, both George H.W. Bush and at points Bill Clinton were unpopular candidates that year, although Clinton became more popular.
The presidential debates are drawing near. What would be the criteria that would guarantee Johnson a place on the roster?
A very important question. The Commission on Presidential Debates has put forth a series of criteria that a candidate has to meet in order to be on the stage, including being on the ballot in enough states to be able to, at least in theory, win the Electoral College. But the one that's interesting, of course, vis-a-vis our discussion, is the candidate has to have 15% in an average of five polls before the debate is held.
We are well past the conventions at this point. There have been bounces and then resets. What are the images of the two leading presidential candidates at this juncture?
I've been spending a lot of time looking at that. The bottom line, Dave, drumroll, is that the image on the part of the American public of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are exactly now what they were in early July before any of this convention stuff happened. Trump did better during his convention. In fact, at one point, Trump's favorable rating tied the favorable rating for Hillary Clinton. As many people like Trump as liked Clinton, and that's never happened before in our tracking. But that didn't last for very long. He faded. Clinton did better during her convention, widened the favorability gap with Trump. But that's settled back down now. And so we're where we started. 39% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Hillary Clinton in early July and now. And for Donald Trump, 31% had a favorable opinion of him in early July, and now that's 32%. So all of the conventions and everything they did and all the publicity and visibility really were for naught in terms of what people think about the candidates.
If these images are so fixed, in part because these are fixtures in America, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, name recognition is off the charts, what could possibly happen between now and Election Day to change it?
Well, the debates are clearly one thing that the candidates look to try to change their images, particularly for these two candidates. I think if you interviewed their campaign teams, they would say they were hoping that the debates would make both of them look better because they both have very negative images, but that didn't work. So we were just talking about it. The next big events on the campaign trail will be those debates that start in late September and then go into the first couple of weeks of October. Those are traditionally places where Americans really focus on the candidates again. But again, based on history, it's unclear to me that the images of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are going to be changed much by anything that happens.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Still ahead, is the North American Free Trade Agreement as bad for the country as Donald Trump says it is?
The impact on the U.S. economy, has been enormous, but it really depends on what part of the U.S. economy we're talking about.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Sometimes inspiration comes when you least expect it.
We were out on vacation and we decided to walk into a Dairy Queen just to get some soft serve. And we walked in and we're like, no one does chef flavors, chef-driven soft serve.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Eureka! And soft serve ice cream next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder. Some New Jersey residents are hoping to end the state's ban on stun guns. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has details.
A lawsuit filed in federal court has its sights set on overturning the Garden State's general prohibition on stun guns and tasers. Mark Cheeseman filed the lawsuit when Taser International refused to ship a stun gun to his New Jersey home, citing the state law. Steven Stambulia is representing Cheeseman and the New Jersey Second Amendment Society in court.
Some people might want to use a taser instead of having to actually kill somebody or to shoot someone. If you want to defend yourself in your home, you're basically left with a bat or a gun. You can't use a taser.
Earlier this year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against a stun gun ban in Massachusetts, saying the reasoning behind the law was flawed. That ruling has spawned suits to overturn stun gun bans across the country, including one this month in the District of Columbia. The New Jersey Attorney General's office says it does not comment on pending cases. And while it might seem intuitive to allow residents to carry generally non-lethal stun guns for self-defense, University of Pennsylvania law professor Paul Robinson says there's an argument to be made against them.
People worry that citizens will use them too easily. That people, if they had firearms that were deadly, would be more hesitant to use them.
Robinson says stun guns can also cause unintended injuries, say if you were to be stunned and then fell down. But he agrees that they are one of the better non-lethal options for self-defense. Earlier this year, former acting New Jersey Attorney General John Hoffman relaxed the rules on stun gun use by police in an effort to cut down on how often they used deadly force. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
During the presidential campaign, both Republican nominee Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton talk a lot about creating jobs and bringing jobs back to the United States. In speeches delivered at campaign stops in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, Donald Trump has called the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, the worst trade deal in history of the country, claiming it sent jobs to Mexico. But is that really true? Mauro Gillen is professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and he's examined the impact of NAFTA on U.S. jobs. Professor Gillen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
first remind us, what exactly is NAFTA?
Well, NAFTA is a trade agreement among Canada, Mexico, and the United States that came into effect in 1993, and it essentially involves free trade in goods and free movement of capital, but of course no free movement of labor. That is to say, Canadians or Mexicans cannot, in principle, come to the United States and work, or Americans cannot go to Mexico or Canada without getting a permit to work either.
And so it was signed more than 20 years ago. Can we say at this point what the impact has been on the U.S. economy?
Well, the impact on the U.S. economy has been enormous, but it really depends on what part of the U.S. economy we're talking about. In terms of consumption, it's very clear that prices for most consumer goods purchased by Americans have been coming down as a result of NAFTA, as a result of free trade in general. So overall, the benefits to the American consumer has been great, and of course, we're all consumers. Now, when it comes to labor, of course, some industries and some workers in the United States have benefited from NAFTA because their skills are aligned with, the economy, the digital economy, and with all of the high-growth industries. But other workers, unfortunately, in some other industries, of course, have suffered. So the effects in terms of employment are a little bit more mixed.
And so I think the implication that Trump and some others have made is that it's driving jobs down to Mexico, jobs that would otherwise be American jobs. Is there evidence that that has happened?
Well, not really, because obviously the jobs, certain kinds of jobs, right, in certain industries like metals, steel, auto parts, and so on and so forth, would have gone somewhere else in the world if it weren't Mexico. Let's also keep in mind that there's been a lot of jobs created in the United States as a result of NAFTA, because, for instance, Japanese and European companies, after NAFTA came into effect back in 1993, felt compelled to establish factories, not just in Mexico, but also here in the United States, to produce things and sell them in this market under free trade conditions. This is not to say, again, that some people have not lost as a result, but overall, the economy, I think, even from the employment point of view, has tended to benefit from the trade deal.
And in a state like Pennsylvania, where, say, the steel industry was very strong up until the point where it wasn't, what can you say about sort of manufacturing jobs in Pennsylvania or other types of jobs in Pennsylvania? Have they gone to other countries?
Well, absolutely, in certain industries, of course. So Pennsylvania, over the last 30 or 40 years, has lost well over a million manufacturing jobs. But at the same time, the state has gained, has created many jobs in other industries, such as healthcare or education, financial services, and so on and so forth. At the present time, we have about 6 million people working in Pennsylvania, and only about 500,000, only 500,000 are working in manufacturing. And that's really the norm for an economy such as the United States. That is to say, as manufacturing has become more productive and some of it has shifted abroad, then we have fewer people employed there. So again, I mean, the issue here is some workers have lost, some workers have won. The key is, can we give workers the skills and the education and the training that they need to succeed in this economy? Because I don't think protectionism is really what's going to fix it.
As I mentioned, Donald Trump has a tendency to say that NAFTA was the worst trade deal ever. Can we say if that's true or not?
Well, I don't agree with that. Let me explain why and link the issue to another topic that he brings up frequently in his rallies, which is immigration. Most of the immigration that comes from Mexico is essentially people who are in Mexico, but they originate from Central America or South America. I think NAFTA has been in the national interest of the United States because it has helped Mexico develop a more dynamic economy, and that's good for the U.S. So I think the benefits of NAFTA have been clear for the United States. It is true, as I've been mentioning, that some people have lost their jobs. But once again, the fix to that, the solution to that, is not protectionism. It should be spending on education and retraining and helping those workers find other opportunities.
Professor Mauro Gillen is a management professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with additional production from Ty Johnson. The news director is Eugene Son. Our engineers this week were Al Banks and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of News and Civic Dialogue. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.